Have you heard about the official sponsor of the London Lyceum and Hanover Press? It's Professor Lending, your premier home financing guide, helping you not only purchase a home, but steward it well for you, your family, and your future. Founded by me, Jordan Stefaniak, and staffed by local church leaders, we exist to bring clarity and trust back into the lending process. Home financing can feel confusing, oftentimes sketchy, and that's why we're here, to offer integrity, transparency, education, and excellent service. Too often, there is zero education in the mortgage process, and you're left completely hanging, and that's not right. That's why you should check us out at ProfessorLending.com. That is ProfessorLending.com. Whether you're a first-time buyer, working with a unique property like a farm, or a builder needing liquidity, or even an investor looking to expand your portfolio, we have solutions tailored for you. So check us out. Professor Lending, financing with integrity for families who care about their future.
I'd like to welcome our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum podcast. I'm Leland Brown, one of your hosts. Joining me today is another one of our hosts, Dr. Hunter Heinzman, and Dr. John Lowe, who is a senior lecturer at the University of Louisville and has several other teaching and research appointments. Looking forward to this discussion today on Jonathan Edwards and slavery. The London Lyceum podcast is a podcast dedicated to serious thinking for a serious church. A couple of values we want to steward as we try to think seriously: critical thinking, cheerful confessionalism, charity, and curiosity. This simply means that we want to think well, not necessarily accept the viewpoints of others, but also come at them with charity and curiosity, genuinely wondering why. This is a really helpful perspective when we encounter difficult subjects and historical figures, particularly a lot of American theologians who in some ways participated in or defended the institution of slavery. So we want to come at these issues thinking critically, comfortable that we're not where they're at, but also being genuinely curious and charitable in our approach. So real excited to welcome you, John. Glad you're here. Would love if you just tell us a bit about your work and any research projects or things coming up that you're excited about.
Sure. Thank you. Thanks to the London Lyceum. Thanks, Leland, Hunter, for having me. So most of my research revolves around race and religion. Well, it's, I guess, the intersection of race and religion during the 18th century, during the First Great Awakening, the decades leading up to the American Revolution. And so I'm mostly interested, I guess my research interests center on how race and religion transform during the periods after the Great Awakening into the American Revolution. So as you can imagine, here celebrating the 250th anniversary of our nation, it's kind of been my bread and butter to read everything that's coming out, write a few things. And so that's been great. A few things that I'm working on, I guess, outside the scope of some of the things that I study. I did a few different articles in the past year on Andrew Fuller and Abraham Booth. I did one, I think both of them, one of them was in the Journal of Reformed Theology. It was on Andrew Fuller, patriotism, benevolence, and abolitionism. And I did something similar. I wrote something similar on Abraham Booth in socio-religious ethics in the 18th century, on his abolitionism and how their ideas of love transferred to a type of disinterested benevolence that they gained from Edwards, similar to the new divinity, and how they applied that in their abolitionism in the 18th century in England. And so I'm working on ideas of that, hoping to expand those perhaps in a full monograph. A few different things just came out with the Civitas Institute down in Texas, the McConnell Center here in Louisville, and a few other smaller projects. But those topics are the things that really interest me and quote unquote get me up in the morning to work and to read.
Yeah, that sounds
great.
That's super, super. No, that's great. That's super interesting. Love that you're doing some studies on Baptists too. That's great. Tell us a little bit about how you got interested in Jonathan Edwards and kind of how this book came to fruition.
Sure.
And the book, by the way, I forgot to mention this to our readers. The book is Benevolence and Bondage.
Yes, Benevolence and Bondage, Jonathan Edwards, Slavery, Race, and the Paradox of Spiritual Equality with University of South Carolina Press. The origins of this book, they really find themselves at a Yale Divinity summer seminar on Edwards. I was studying up there. I think I was a THM student at Southern Seminary at the time. And I went up there for a class credit. I took this Yale seminar on Edwards. And it was on Edwards and the Bible. It was led by Ken Minkema, who was eventually one of my supervisors for my dissertation, and Adrian Neely. And during that week, we read portions of the Bible on different topics. And I distinctly remembering reading a passage that was on the syllabus about Edwards and slavery. And I had known about George Whitefield's participation in slavery, but I had not really been familiar that Edwards was a full-born enslaver of Africans. And it really hit me because I guess I'm guilty of being, you know, a young MDiv, young THM student, you know, and you kind of idolize some of your heroes and think that, you know, that, oh, because they had this great mind, they're unflawed, they're extremely holy, and things like that, which Edwards and Whitefield was. But I remember sitting there thinking, well, how is it that this leader of the Great Awakening, you know, this great preacher, this great theologian, this great mind, how could he enslave or practice slavery? And so it was mind-boggling at the time, and I was I felt very deflated, you know, in a moment, you know, very, very confused. And so it eventually became my THM, my master's thesis. I wrote only 70 pages or something on Edwards and slavery. And then I took that, I used it as my dissertation at VU Amsterdam and expanded it to Edwards, slavery, and race within an historical, cultural, religious context. And so I've really been studying this topic for over a decade. If you go all the way back to 2014, 2015, something like that. So it's very, pleasing to finally see my work in print, you know, to a degree, to be like, okay, great, it's finished. But realizing that it's not really finished. People have to read it first. You know, there's no sense in writing books if no one's going to read them. So yeah, that's how it really came about. I was very interested in how, you know, someone that we would probably consider, you know, an evangelical Christian, you know, be so blind to something that's wicked, really.
You know, Jonathan Edwards is one of those figures that's so familiar to us in a popular sense that sometimes the particulars of who he is and what he believed can be less familiar because of his kind of an ironic paradox of somebody being super popular in the popular mind. But I know you've also written on this for a decade, like you said, but how would you summarize, and I know you've written like a book on this, but how would you summarize his views on slavery and race? Kind of like, what would be the elevator kind of pitch or elevator summary of his positions on those two things?
Sure. Edwards's position is, it's not innovative. It was somewhat common during the 18th century and even the 17th century, late 17th century. He defends slavery as an institution, but he is against the slave trade. So he is very much against how people are being captured, being brought over here, or then to the colonies, to North America, the way they're treated. He's very much aware of this, how the slave trade is being conducted, right? So he's very much against that. So he defends slavery as an institution. He's against the slave trade. And his views on race are definitely confusing at times. I would say more than being a racist, he's an ethnocentrist. So he sees the British way of life, British culture, as far superior to any other, far superior to the French, the Portuguese, Spanish, and to the Native Americans. So he sees it. He sees the British colonial ethos as far superior, but he sees their spiritual state similar to everyone else. That everyone is in need of a savior. Everyone is sinful. Everyone needs Jesus, and everyone needs to have the gospel heard and respond. And we see that whenever he's in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, and he preaches the same gospel. It's preached differently, with its nuance, with different imagery to the Native Americans, but it's the same gospel. And so he makes this what I call in the book a civil spirit dualism. Right, he sees that someone's spiritual station and their civil station are different. And so just because you free someone is spiritually free in Christ does not relieve them of their civil station. And so in that way, he's able to defend slavery as an institution and not a religious one. So his Puritanism kind of comes out then, you know, don't rebel against a divine, God-ordained hierarchy. You know, to do that would be rebellion against God. So in this way, when Edwards defends slavery as an institution, not a racially motivated one, he's not rebelling against God, and he's at the same time able to preach a gospel to all people without regard.
It's really good. So I have so many questions after you said this thing. So this can be just a couple. So I'd love to hear a little bit about Edwards' sort of hermeneutics. I mean, a lot of people in the South, primarily in the later on before the Civil War, would just sort of like say, hey, look, Colossians 4 says it's okay, so it's okay. So was Edwards sort of that simplistic in his defense of slavery? Was he a little more nuanced? And then just on the discussion of the spiritual civil dualism, I forget the term you just said. Is that, like, would you describe that as like more of seeing society as a hierarchy, or like racism as it came to be later on in the South? Like, where would you place Edwards on that continuum? That's a lot of stuff, but just one of those questions, or we can come back to another one. Would love to hear your thoughts.
Sir, what was the first one? The first one was
just his hermeneutics, like how he used the Bible. Yeah. Did he have a theological perspective, or was he just kind of saying, hey, Deuteronomy says it's fine, Colossians says it's fine, it must be fine? Like, that sort of simplistic hermeneutics that became normal in the South in defense of slavery.
Yeah, he's somewhat silent on the issue, really. The only text that we really have where he specifically addresses slavery, and that's the purpose of his writing, is a draft letter on slavery that Ken Minkema found a few decades ago. And he's defending another minister who is an Arminian, Benjamin Doolittle, that's in the area. And he actually defends this Arminian minister because this minister is enslaving someone. And he doesn't give a lot of biblical support for his defense. And in fact, when you go through his blank Bible, which most people know is the closest thing to a commentary that we have by Edwards, he does not address the issues of slavery in the common places that we would think. So Ephesians 6, he doesn't address it. He doesn't write anything down. Philemon, there's two lines in the blank Bible, and none of it addresses slavery. I think it's Galatians 5. There's neither slave nor free, no Jew or Greek, doesn't address it. He doesn't mention slavery. So in all these, I think it's Romans 3, we're talking about where Paul, the Apostle Paul, is talking about, you know, we're no longer slaves of sin. We're slaves of Christ. Edwards writes nothing. So there's just this silence to Edwards, where I think you can gather that he feels a little bit uncomfortable with it, because by the time, well, after the First Great Awakening, you know, it kind of prods the issue of slavery in colonial America, right? So I think Edwards is somewhat uncomfortable. Simply, he just doesn't write a whole lot about it. There is one place in, I believe it's Job, where Edward is talking about the master-slave relationship, but he still does not speak directly to slavery as an institution in his blank Bible. A few places that he does address it is, I think, from Deuteronomy, when people are saying, people during his time are justifying what's commonly referred to as man-stealing, but Edwards would call it disfranchising people. So the slaves that are coming from Africa, they're not war captives, they're not criminals, they're simply being captured for the purposes of slavery. So Edwards is very much against that. He writes from Deuteronomy, Deuteronomy or Exodus, where God allowed the Israelites to plunder the Egyptians and take everything. And Edwards says, God allowed something to happen doesn't necessarily make it a rule. He said, God doesn't wink at such things anymore. Like, just because he permitted something one time in the Bible doesn't necessarily mean that it's our rule or a law that we as Christians can live by today in the New Testament era, I guess you would call it. So he definitely does not see slavery as, or the practice of slavery as, evil. He never calls it sin in his draft letter or anywhere in his blank Bible, his miscellanies, the history of worker redemption. He never calls slavery sin. And I think it's because he was so true to the Bible, where the Bible never called, the practice of slavery as a sin. And so Edwards wasn't going to take a step beyond the Bible and say, okay, well, this is sin. He did not do that in his reading of the scriptures. What was the second question? Where does Edwards fall? How does Southern Christians, where does he fall in that continuum of hermeneutic? There are Baptists and Presbyterians in the American South that really like Edwards. So Oliver Hart, Richard Furman, they like Edwards a whole lot, but their hermeneutic is somewhat different. They're very explicit in their, in Furman's defense of slavery. His sermons, I think someone will probably correct me in the comments, probably Aubie Tyler Todd, since he's written so much on Richard Furman. But I think Richard Furman wrote the first Baptist defense of slavery in the American South. And it's littered with scripture and in his defense. And Edwards just doesn't do that. And similar to Edwards, Furman does not really colorize a lot of his defense or any of his defense of slavery. It's strictly an institution. And that's somewhat where Edwards is different than his Puritan predecessors, right? The Puritan predecessors, such as the Mathers, specifically Cotton Mather, who wrote, several works on the institution of slavery. His is very racist, makes notes to color. He says, he instructs Africans and Native Americans, don't sin to make yourselves more black than you already are. He says instead, repent of your sin and you yourselves will be whiter than snow. This is Cotton Mather speaking. Edwards, Furman, Hart, they don't say anything like that. They don't mention color at all. They strictly stick to biblical interpretation, what the Bible says about it, not what the Bible doesn't say about it. So it's very interesting when you, sorry, go ahead, Hunter.
Oh, go ahead. I was just going to ask then, you spoke of this kind of civic and spiritual kind of dualism where they are spiritually equal, but they need to stick to their civic status, so to speak. What did he ground that dualism in? I mean, it doesn't sound like he was a Curse of Ham kind of guy. Maybe he was. I don't know. You could speak to that. But what did he ground? If it wasn't racial and is so much as what was it class? And I know you mentioned he viewed the French kind of down, a little bit lower. I think sometimes today we kind of highlight people, persons of color and then white people, just European general in general. Did it seem like he operated with that kind of viewpoint? So how did he kind of cash out and ground his civic hierarchy, I guess, if it wasn't racial?
Sure. Yeah. This might surprise some people. And I guess if you read my book, then you'll notice that there's nothing in Edwards' literary corpus that suggests that his defense of slavery was racially motivated. So he never says, okay, because I believe in the curse of Ham theory, which he doesn't. And there are several other ministers at the time that reject the curse of Ham theory. And if you're not familiar with the curse of Ham theory, it's where Ham is cursed by Noah after the flood to be the servants of his brothers. And the assumption is that the descendants of Ham, they populated Africa, specifically Ethiopia. And because of this curse, this Noahic or curse of Ham, they are destined by God's providence to be slaves. That's the idea. Edwards he never mentions, at least from what I've read, he does not mention the curse of Ham by name, but he would reject that people, because of their skin color, because of who they've descended from, are destined to be servants of other people. So there are other people later on, a century later or less than a century later, in the American South that stick to the curse of Ham theory. People like Dabney, other Southern Presbyterians, other Baptist ministers. It's other Methodists actually that reject the curse of Ham theory. People like Francis Asbury, things like that. People like that. So the way that he situates or he defends this civil spiritual dualism is in his draft letter on slavery. He says, well, this institution, similar to other Puritans before him, he defends the institution. Well, this isn't ideal. Of course, I'm paraphrasing. I'm interpreting Edwards here. He said, this isn't ideal. That is the practice of slavery, but it's the institution that has been handed down to us. That's basically his take. This is, you know, in a broken world, you know, in a perfect, sinless, flawless world, we wouldn't need civil government. But it's an institution that's been handed down by God. So civil institution, like civil institution, slavery has been handed down to humanity to practice and so forth. And he gives this analogy. So he says, you know, slavery can be like food and drink, right? So he says, if you drink and eat too much, it would lead to gluttony, which is obvious as sin. But food and drink themselves are not a sin. So if you practice slavery within the biblical parameters, then it itself is permissible, even though it's not ideal. So he gives that analogy in his draft letter. So he very much defends slavery as an institution. He uses a civil spiritual dualism in the way that he thinks about slavery and race. So with that interpretation, he can say, okay, he can preach a gospel to all people, regardless of skin color, regardless of station in life, call them to freedom in Christ without saying, oh, and you know, just because you're an enslaved person, that doesn't mean you're free. It doesn't mean that it doesn't alleviate you of your civil station in life. And he would say, in fact, you know, the scriptures would contradict that. They would say, hey, you need to be, you know, Ephesians 6, even though he didn't give any commentary to this in his blank Bible. He would say, no, you need to obey the scriptures, and the scriptures say, you know, to obey your master. So that's how he kind of gets around it. Did that answer it fully, or do you need something else?
Yeah, that's good. So just, you know, obviously in a project like this, you have spent a lot of time with Jonathan Edwards, and you kind of, I imagine, just he wrote a bunch, but you kind of know his posture, his work. Does this sort of dualism, what you call just a non-racial justification of slavery, Knowing Edwards, is that super surprising to you? Does that seem like an exception in his view of the world and his theology? Or do you see ways in which kind of how he viewed the world and how he, like does it seem to make not sense? I mean, we don't want to justify by any means, but like is the way he navigated and talked about this issue, is it consistent with his broader perspective or something that's like sort of a glaring inconsistency of his?
I think it is. I think it's very consistent with his theology. However, I was very surprised to discover that his defense of slavery was not necessarily racially motivated. You know, I was expecting him to say similar things from people of people at the time, other ministers, you know, degrading Africans, you know, saying that, you know, they're, you know, subhuman. You know, just a few decades earlier, I mean, you have Samuel Sewall and John Safin, the famous anti-slavery pamphlet, and they say, you know, they say some of the grossest inhumane things about Africans in their appearance, how they don't have, you know, the mental capacity to have orderly families and stuff. And this is the year Edwards was born, whenever it was published, excuse me, a year before Edwards was born. And so by the time Edwards is writing in the 1740s, 1750s, where he writes much of his literary corpus, he's not saying the same things that ministers were, you know, in his same class, the upper echelons of white colonial America. You know, he's not saying the same things. He's not attaching color to his defense of slavery. So I was surprised. I thought Edwards would most definitely, it would be easy for him, right? For him to kind of fit the niche of, you know, his peers at the time to say, well, you know, that's just, you know, it's because, you know, they're black or they're Tawnies, which is, Tawnies is just an archaic term to describe someone who's brown of skin, like someone who's perhaps Native American, someone who's perhaps, you know, my skin color. I'm surprised that he does not attach that to his defense of slavery. But that's different when it comes to, I guess maybe not so different when it comes to his views on Native Americans, because he, so there's at times he doesn't hold back when he describes Native Americans. He would, you know, call them heathens, that the devil sucks their blood. You know, he would describe them, in negative terms, but he doesn't say, well, it's because they're not white, or it's because they're brown, because they act this way. He doesn't say anything like that. So I think that was very surprising for me. To the other part of your question, I do think he's pretty consistent with the rest of his theology in the history of work of redemption. Everyone, regardless of skin color, needs the gospel. And he, because of his reading of the Bible, he predicts that one day, you know, there'll be great, you know, Christian writers who will produce books in China, Ethiopia, you know, and here in America and things like that. So I don't think that he believed, you know, well, they're people of color, they're kind of stuck in their mental capacity, but once they've been enlightened by the gospel, they will be just like whites. This is Edwards speaking, you know, Edwards' thought process. And so I think he's fairly consistent. Where I think he is conflicted is in his practice. So I think if he would have followed along with his ideas of love, benevolence, I think it would eventually he would have eventually manumitted his enslaved people like his followers.
So, John, you bring us to the next big part of your book that I appreciated. So we've talked through sort of the bondage elements that you've examined in slavery. Tell us more about Edwards's understanding of benevolence, disinterested benevolence, that sort of virtue, how he pictured that just theologically. And then you know, I'd love to discuss sort of his influence on his heirs and their work in abolition.
Sure. Much of what Edwards's ideas of love or benevolence, it comes from Charity and Its Fruits, his work, Charity and Its Fruits. It was preached in the 1730s. I don't believe it was published until the early 1740s. And he focuses, obviously, on a popular verse about love, 1 Corinthians 13, right? We hear it at weddings, and it's commonly read when we want a biblical definition of love. And he hones in on this, and he says, you know what? This Greek word here, agape, it's probably better translated as charity. You know, very, very Augustinian. You two patristic guys would be able to perhaps hone in on this one. His Augustine comes out and he says, you know what? This is probably better translated as charity. You know, instead of just the regular English love, it's charity. And why is that? Because he talks about the verse and he says, because it's not love, this type of love, it's not just an affection. It's not just an emotion or desire that I have inside of me. It's something that should be demonstrated, right? You know, if you have love for something, you know, it might look differently than if you were charitable towards someone, meaning that you gave them something, you know, you showed them love or demonstrated love to them in some way. So in Charity and Its Fruits, he says, you know, this might be, this word here, agape, probably better rendered to be charity. And so he says that he goes into a long defense. We don't have time, you know, to read it or anything, but he says this is the type of benevolence, this true Christian benevolence, you know. The sum of all virtues is love, or this type of charity, is what he's writing in Charity and Its Fruits. And it's this idea where if I'm going to be if I'm going to be an authentic Christian, if I'm going to be, you know, express true religion in his words, then I must demonstrate this biblical type of love or benevolence. And so who should I, and naturally Edwards, you know, he's thinking, well, who should I show this to? Naturally, the highest one, God, you know, the highest person in the created order, or he would call being in general, this system or chain of being, everything in the created order, all intelligent beings. So first, my benevolence or charity should be demonstrated to God. Naturally, then it should be demonstrated to other people, my neighbors, right? So he writes this, Samuel Hopkins, his closest student, his son, Jonathan Edwards Jr., his other, another well-known student of his, Joseph Bellamy, his other student, well, not student, but a reader of his, Lemuel Haynes, they take this idea of benevolence and they turn it into a religio-social ethic. So they take this type of benevolence and say, okay, I know, they take Edwards' theology of benevolence and say, okay, well, I know I'm supposed to demonstrate love to God, but, you know, are other people, well, who's my neighbor, basically? You know, if I'm supposed to demonstrate it to other people, is it limited to only a certain people? And Hopkins takes this idea of benevolence and he transforms it into, and he claims that he's explained Edwards more fully. He says, well, this type of true Christian benevolence or love should be disinterested benevolence, meaning that in order to show true Christian love, that I have to maximize it to the highest good toward God and people. And for Hopkins in the late 18th century, who are the people that need charity the most? Enslaved Africans. And so because they're being oppressed, because they're being treated poorly, Hopkins, Edwards Jr., Bellamy, others of the New Divinity at the time think, okay, well, if I'm going to be an authentic Christian, if I really have true religion, then I need to maximize my love to the highest good. And where can I maximize my charity? Who can I maximize my charity to? Well, it's not, you know, the Joneses on the corner who have, you know, all the riches. They have, you know, a white picket fence. They're not oppressed, you know, at all. It's the enslaved Africans. They're the ones suffering, especially Christians, especially Africans and Native Americans who have converted to Christianity. How are they receiving Christian love? And so Hopkins takes this idea of disinterested benevolence, and it's what fuels his abolitionism. He says, okay, well, you know, if I see all these people oppressed, then who am I, you know, who am I just to turn a blind eye to it? I can't if I have true religion. If I am an authentic Christian and I see someone being oppressed and suffer, and I'm only thinking about my inward good, I have self-interest, not disinterested. If I'm self-interested, then that is not true religion. And so he takes this idea and he takes it to, it's what fuels his abolitionism. And later, Fuller, Andrew Fuller, Abraham Booth, other readers of Edwards would have the same ideas.
So this idea of disinterest, is it kind of flowing from kind of a duty-based view of ethics, kind of a break from, you know, I'm not saying that they're, you know, reading Kant or influenced by him or anything like that, but is that kind of the idea, or is there something different there? Like, if you're deriving joy in the expression of love, then that shows a less ethical view. Is that kind of what we're talking about here, or does it fit with kind of the idea of finding enjoyment in loving and serving God and others?
Yeah, they're at least Hopkins and Edwards Jr. They think that finding joy in serving and perhaps relieving people from their stations of slavery, the joy they get that from that is glorifying to God. So it's not altruistic. Part of the reason why Edwards writes Charity and Its Fruits and focuses on love is because he's writing against some of the enlightened French Enlightenment thinkers, such as Francis Hutcheson, who talk about the pure amour movement, where the pure love movement, where you know, you can have love, you can express love, and you can enjoy helping someone, but you know, God doesn't really have to be in it. That's in a very much, or you don't need really God at all to express true love. This is French Enlightenment thinking during the 18th century. And Edwards is writing very much against that. And so the feelings that Hopkins, Edwards Jr. Have, the new divinity, they would say that the joy that they get from it is not only helping someone, but also glorifying God as an example. Okay, I'm showing true Christian love here. That not only helps someone else, but it glorifies God. Showing love to one's neighbor is also showing love to God. And so this ethic that they possess, they would see it as some type of Christian obligation, not in a sense I have to do this as in order to score points with the Father. I do this because I'm a true Christian. Right. This is simply the outworkings of salvation, right? To demonstrate love to others, whether it relieves their, you know, relieves them from oppression or their station in life. So their ethic is, they would see it as an obligation, not because they have to, because they get to, as a Christian.
And you would say this, the development of a disinterested benevolence is a development from Edwards. It's based on his theology, but it goes a little bit beyond it. Or how would you describe that relationship between the way Edwards describes this benevolence and charity and the way the later guys did? Is the development primarily just they applied it to slavery, or is there a development in thought too?
There is the development of this idea of benevolence from Edwards is, I think, definitely transformed by his followers, not so much as the theology like proper, but it's transformed in how it's applied. So I'm not sure if Edwards would agree. Many scholars would agree that Edwards would have read Hopkins's and his son's theology and be in full agreement with it, because it's almost, you know, it's almost word for word in some places. But the difference is where Edwards neglected to apply it. So Hopkins doesn't see a God-ordained hierarchy in the same way that Edwards did. Edwards would have said, your station in life and everything about it is God-ordained, providentially been ordained, and to free yourself from that is rebellion against God. And so Hopkins would say, absolutely not. You know, this station in life, you know, you can be free from it. you know, to demonstrate love, if it means freeing someone from their station, well, then like, so be it. Like, so he really takes Edwards's theology and, you know, kind of turns it on its head and says, well, you know, real love is can free someone from their station, that even if God's like ordained it, it can change. And so this the difference between Samuel Hopkins and Jonathan Edwards is mainly an application. It's not so much, I think, in their theology of love. It's how they applied it.
One of the things I appreciate about this project is it gets to just the weirdness of history, and that there's no, that Jonathan Edwards being pro-slavery, in some sense, his ideas get used and furthered to drive the force of one of the largest abolitionist movements in the Americas. And just thinking through that, could you speak to just the discipline of history and to others who might be engaging in it as to what this project has taught you about how to do history well, how not to, maybe even speak to some of the ways in which you've seen Jonathan Edwards be used poorly in public discourse. You know, I'm not saying you have to name names or anything like that, but just general contours on either side, doesn't matter which one you want to key in on. But just could you speak to that, kind of the appropriate way to engage in historical studies into topics that are controversial and even have kind of impact on some important discussions in the present day?
Sure. I would say one of the first things that one has to do is approach it when they do, you know, anything in life, is approach it with humility. You know, in my case, I was very confused. I didn't know what Edwards's position on slavery and race would be. I didn't know. I definitely had an assumptions of what it would be, and just have the humility to think that you might be wrong about something. No one is boasting that they're a perfect historian. Well, I guess there are perhaps some people who do, but to approach a project in historical studies and say, okay, well, I might not like what I find, you know, and to please people and to look through, or read sources through a particular lens, I think is not the purpose of history. You know, I have this idea of such and such, and I'm only going to look at the sources that support this idea, or I'm only going to read a text in a way that I think, in a way I think it should be read, you know, not in the way that the authors would have written them. So, having an open mind, being willing to be willing to think about the sources in a way that's honest, because pleasing people or attaching your research to a specific narrative, you have flawed history then, and try not to make the sources say what you want it to say, which has become very evident in some of the most recent scholarship that's been put out. Knowing that Edwards probably would have, you know, looked at someone like myself, someone who's, you know, not white, you know, not British, and to think that I was lesser than, you know, that was always an interesting thought. So, but I never wanted to make Edwards say what I think he should have said, or what I think it should be said of him. At the very beginning, well, during the process of my writing, what I would do is that I would read things online, whether it be on like Facebook, then Twitter, or anything like that, and I would take screenshots of what people were saying, not to come back and like dunk on them later and be like, "Ha, you're wrong," but just to see what genuinely people thought about the subject, what people thought Edwards's views on slavery and race were, what are people genuinely saying about him, something that I can answer. And so hopefully I did that. And I understand that many people are probably not going to be pleased with the book. It's going to be, some people are going to think that you know, that wasn't as hard as on Edwards as I should have been. Some people will say that, you know, well, that was too hard, you know, but pleasing people is never the purpose of writing history. That and just simply clarification on some of the issues. There are some things on social media. There are others, there are so-called scholars like Anthony Bradley, Kyle James Howard, others like them that suggest that, you know, Edwards most definitely beat his slaves. You know, he was, you know, dyed-in-the-wool racist just like the other Puritans. When really, at least what I've read, there's absolutely nothing that supports the idea that he beat his slaves or mistreated them in the slightest. There's nothing. And if a letter or another manuscript comes to light later down the road that Edwards explicitly says, you know, oh, hey, you know, I did this, that, and the other, well, then we have to take it and take it for what it is. But until that point, you can't say that. There's no factual information. And I'm just, it's wild to me that people that are in this world of academia would make such wild assertions without any type of historical evidence. So that might upset, you know, some people that, you know, I don't mention that, but the problem is that neither does Edwards. You know, it's not mentioned in the manuscripts whatsoever that he did anything of the sort. So where do we go? You know, where do we go with Edwards today? You know, does he offer us anything? And so I guess that what dovetails with that is that people, okay, he was an enslaver. You know, are we supposed to read, you know, how can we take, you know, can we take anything away from Edwards? Should we use Edwards? Should we read him or anything like that? There's a homily by Basil the Great. You two patristic guys will like that I'm dipping into some Cappadocian fathers. He writes a homily called Drinking the Honey Without the Poison. I think that's the translation. He drinks honey. You can drink the honey without the poison. And what he's referring to is the Greek Paideia, and you can read, you know, something that is not written by a Christian and still gain something, still glean something beneficial from it. Now, I do believe that Edwards, you know, was a Christian, despite some of the things that he did, like practicing slavery. But I think that it would be more than beneficial for Christians to read him, since he is a near endless well of deep thinking of who God is and how should I live my life for him. It's just, I've rarely read anyone else that just has not only the candor, but the philosophical and theological depth that he has. So I think if you do away with that, you do away with Edwards simply because he supported the institution and practice of slavery, then you're really throwing the baby out with the bathwater at that point.
John, this has been a fascinating discussion. And I, again, like Hunter, just really appreciate your just genuine historical work and sort of just digging in the sources and trying to say what they're saying. Just one very quick final question. You just encouraged us to read some Edwards. Where would you encourage one of our listeners to start? What would you say? Here are the couple things I'd say. Start with this on Edwards, and then we can close.
Sure. Most people want others to read Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, his most famous sermon. But I would say read The History of Work of Redemption. It gives a glimpse of how Edwards was seeing the world progressing and what it was going to be. He knew that in the end, Christianity would win, that God would glorify himself, and that all nations would be saved, and that scripture would indeed be fulfilled. And so I think that the history of the work of the redemption would be a great place to start.
Great. Well, John, thanks so much for joining us. Thanks for your scholarship. Look forward to reading more by you.
Thank you.
And to our listeners, thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Len Lyceum, the only Baptist confessional analytic podcast on the planet. Until we meet again, stay Baptist.
So.
Hey friends, this is just a periodic reminder that if you're a loyal listener of the London Lyceum, you are welcome to join our underground Slack group, where we talk about things related to the London Lyceum, things related to theology and philosophy and history in general, and things that are more outside of that sphere as well. It's a lot of fun. We got a lot of pastors, a lot of academic students, a lot of just normal people. We hang out, we talk, and we have a good time, and we can have sort of off-the-grid discussions about things that matter. So if you're interested in joining, just find us on our website and just drop us a note, find the little contact button, send us an email, and let us know that you'd like to be added, and we'd be happy for you to join. It's a lot of fun, and we look forward to talking to you there.